On the show today, what's in a face? Often, to understand how technology will change our lives, we just need to watch a movie. Like this one, released in 2021.
So The Champion was a film shot and made in Poland. So everyone's speaking basically Polish or German.
This is Mike Seymour. He's a researcher at the University of Sydney and works in the film industry in special effects.
And it's a great film. It's a true story about one of the first members of Auschwitz who was a boxer. Terribly moving story, but of course, only in Polish or German.
And usually when there's a foreign film that wants to break into the English-speaking market, there are three options.
Dubbing it, so we get somebody else to voice over a different piece of dialogue, but of course the lips aren't right, so it looks kind of odd.
Or there's subtitles.
Or we have the new version of what we call facial reenactment.
Facial reenactment. It's a new technique that Mike and his team used on The Champion.
We got involved as part of a team to convert the entire film to English.
König des Ausweichens von Warschau.
So now if you were to watch the film in English, every actor speaks as if they'd been shot in English.
The Dutch King of Warsaw, totaling almost 100 fights in bantam and featherweight.
So we've replaced effectively the actors' faces with their own faces, saying the lines in English.
He looks more like a small rooster plucked of its feathers than a champion.
Okay, so Mike, when I watch this English version, it's seamless. It's like their mouths, their faces, everything looks like it was originally shot this way in English. Is this common in the industry? Is it normal?
Well, it's the first time anyone's done it in the world, but hopefully it's going to become normal. In fact, in the
As Mike went on to explain, months after filming, the actors re-recorded all their lines in English as cameras taped their voices and facial expressions. And then, through a process called neural rendering technology, their faces were replaced. So it looks like the film was just shot twice in two different languages.
Come on, Chetty! Come on!
The film industry is always pioneering new tech to trick our eye, to make someone or something look real. But over the last few years, Mike has been developing ways to use these techniques in our real lives.
Yeah, could we take this tech and just sort of use it outside the film industry? That fascinated me, where I say, well, hey, I don't want to get shaven and put on a suit for my important meeting today. So I'll just flip a switch and get digital makeup and I'll look a whole lot better and a whole lot smarter. And I would be able to say, speak in Korean when I absolutely can't speak in Korean. And that, we hope, would facilitate much more genuine communications across cultural divides.
Wow. You're saying that maybe one day if I have relatives all over the world who speak all different languages, but maybe one day we could do FaceTime and it would sound as though I was speaking fluent Swedish and they were speaking back to me. Well, they can speak English, but that we would hear each other's native tongue and wouldn't know the difference. It would look as though I could speak fluent Swedish, but it wouldn't look like I was not myself.
Yes, there is a lot of modern technology that's very sophisticated that would, we think, benefit from being able to have an extra layer of communication that you get from face-to-face interaction. We're kind of this nexus point where that's possible.
Mike Seymour picks up from the TED stage.
We're interested in being able to see if we can put a face on technology, because how would you react when a computer reacts to you with a smile? Would a six-year-old learn maths better if there was a six-year-old teacher on the screen? What about if it was a slightly older version of herself? Would a grandparent having a cup of tea be more likely to check in with a computer system if they didn't have to log in and type? They could just talk to a virtual agent that actually was somebody from their past. This is what we're excited to explore with digital humans. Our ability to produce digital humans up until recently has been quite limited, but we're now seeing interactive digital humans starting to appear. The doors are opening. We are at an inflection point. We have this perfect storm of faster GPU graphics cards, new artificial intelligence deep learning algorithms, and great advances in game engines. It's an incredible combination of things coming together. This tremendous nexus of points is just providing us with an extraordinary opportunity of things that we can do. The important thing about this technology is that we can now use this to get these faces to work with us in real time. In other words, and this is a really key point, the faces that we're talking about can talk, interact, and see us.
Okay, putting faces on our technology. Tell me more about how you see this working and the reasons why we would want it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot. Already in New Zealand, there is automatic sign languaging. So if somebody is speaking a digital human signs in for the deaf community, you might have an assistant sitting in on a Zoom call that you can ask to help book future things, take notes, do stuff. In aged care, you could have an assistant that logs in with somebody each day and makes sure that they're okay and are lucid and they've taken their pills, not to replace a healthcare worker, but just simply that to make sure that they're okay and facilitate them staying in the home longer. And so in a world where we're saying, hey, you know, even to use the phone, there are no buttons now. You have to, you know, swipe up, swipe left, do all this stuff. People are like, I have trouble with that. And so we could bring a face from their past that would be the one that they interact with that technology.
You don't think that would be odd to someone that if you said, well, this is your sister, she's not actually your sister. She just kind of looks like your sister and she's going to help you use your phone. That, I don't know, that might freak me out.
Yeah, you know, you've just touched on a really interesting point. People, when asked, traditionally say, I wouldn't like that. So if you project ahead, you say, hey, would you have a digital human tell you what to do? No, absolutely not. That would be freaky. And yet, every time we do a lab test, they completely don't do that.
I looked up one of those services that might be available in the near future.
Hello, this is Sol, Dr. Beanie's assistant.
Hello, Sol. This is Tyler. I wanted to ask you about my recent surgery.
In the demo video, a man is home after knee surgery and consults on his laptop with his AI nurse. Sol seemed to know her stuff.
The discharge summary states that you should take the pain medicine about 20 minutes before you put on your headset for your virtual reality meditation therapy.
Mike, I don't know. I have to be honest. I was a little unnerved by Sol.
Sure. What I would say is it was her lack of authenticity that probably bothered you, not the digital representation of the face. Once you get to a certain level of quality, you kind of pass what we've referred to as the uncanny valley. So you now got something that looks pretty darn good. It doesn't matter whether you can tell it's real or not. That's not the deciding factor. It's the authenticity of the emotional kind of response that matters. And that's the driving factor. And so for us to succeed in those cases, we really need to make sure that it's the sort of the back end behind the face that's delivering what's wanted, not so much the face itself.
Speaking of the uncanny valley, you did a demonstration on stage where you showed off a very realistic digital version of your head, your face, on a screen that you could control.
Hi, I'm Mike. Well, kind of virtual Mike, really. This is our Digital Human Project, which is a collaboration of a whole bunch of people coming together to produce, well, a virtual human. And not only a virtual human.
I mean,
human,
people, like right now, we can make digital avatars of ourselves, but not like this, not to this realistic extent. How hard was that to build?
We sort of are close. I mean, that one took a lot of people. So we scanned my face and I got my face done in one of the most high-resolution facial scanning systems in the world. It produced this super realistic version of my head. Then I could puppeteer that in real time or have it driven.
So how do we do it? So first we scanned my face. This allowed us to produce a very complex digital avatar of my head, or a digital puppet. Then with a camera mounted on a head rig, the computer can actually read my face. An advanced AI engine then basically interprets that into expressions. Now the computer can tell the digital puppet what to do. In effect, what's happening is it's the computer telling the muscles in the digital mic how to smile, talk, or do things.
It makes me wonder if we might get to a point where kids think, well, I would much rather deal with my extremely realistic looking tutor on my laptop who responds to me, but who doesn't actually give me a hard time and won't be offended if I tell it to shut up. How do we make sure that people don't choose these artificially intelligent agents over humans?
Brilliant question, and I wish I had a definitive answer. I can only give you my hope. So imagine I'm a vet, I come back, but I'm an 18-year-old guy. I've experienced some horrendous experiences in a conflict, and I'm now suffering from all sorts of sexual dysfunction. I cry at night. I have like things that I'm really embarrassed about and ashamed of. I kind of want help, but I don't want to have to sit there and tell a doctor that. But I'd actually like my doctor to know all that so that they can help me. If there are ways where you can communicate that to a effectively like a digital nurse, a digital doctor substitute, so that the system can know it, but you don't have to face them and look them in the eye and say, you know, I have sexual dysfunction. But you can then get treatment and help, and the system knows and can look after you. That's a tremendous benefit. So hopefully for that generation, there'll be tools that appear in their everyday life that just make it a bit easier and reconnects them with people, not takes them away. And I'd like to think that if I had teenagers who were in distress and teenagers that were struggling, if there were tools that helped them, that would do just that. It would help them. It wouldn't replace human contact.
In a minute, the ethical dilemmas with giving our technology a face. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stick with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And on the show today, what's in a face? We were just hearing from Mike Seymour, a film industry veteran who now wants our virtual helpers to look and act more human.
Hi, I'm Mike. Well, kind of virtual Mike, really. This is our digital human project, which is a virtual human, but one rendered in real time. Puppeteered or driven in real time, rendered in real time, and not only that.
Mike says that technology with a face can better interact with us, talk to patients about how they're feeling, ask students where they're struggling in algebra, coach brain injury survivors to be more self-sufficient. So many different types of technology, so many different use case scenarios, as you've mentioned. I expect we're going to see this area explode in the next few years. But along the way, wow, do we have a lot of ethical dilemmas to sort out. I mean, you're just reminding me, we've talked about this on the show a lot, the deep fakes. You know, there's the famous case of seeing President Obama giving a speech that he never gave. Where do you see some of the pitfalls that we need to watch out for?
Manoush, I completely agree with you. Some of the applications of this technology by what I would describe as bad actors is appalling and just, you know, absolutely indefensible. It's a really interesting sort of, I guess, fundamental ethical question. Is the technology good or evil, or is it the use of it and the application of it? And I only can say this. For me personally, you can use steel to make ambulances or tanks. I'm in the business of trying to see if we can't use it to make lots of good ambulances. I know some people are going to make tanks, but that's something I don't have any control over. But I do feel that it's going to happen. And the best line of defense we have to the deception that can be done by this technology is an informed public. So if you see something that's highly improbable, you're going to say, hang on a second, that's probably been faked or not real, or you'll dig in to try and discover its authenticity. So there's a lot of ways we can produce inaccurate material, but an informed public that is aware of what's going on, that understands what the sort of limits of technology are and, you know, where it's going is vital to being able to do this sort of stuff. So,
but are we just barreling towards a future where, you know, your identity gets stolen, but it's not just your social security number, it's your face that can make it look like you're handing over your bank account number to someone on a Zoom call? Like, or is my imagination way ahead of the technology?
Gosh, I mean, people will deceive people with this technology. But yeah, when I'm talking about these AIs, they work very well when you've got a limited amount of stuff that you're asking them to do. So if I was having an agent that was helping you as a maths tutor, and it was discussing maths and explaining mathematical concepts, that could be completely plausible and look photorealistic and wonderful. But if I asked my maths assistant, what does it mean to understand existential philosophy in France? It would completely blank out. So we're not talking about a general intelligence. People quickly extrapolate to that, but we are so far away from that. General AI intelligence is a long way off. But as I say, these plausible, realistic, domain-specific applications in health, in aged care, in all of these sort of parts of everyday life, completely plausible and extremely likely to happen because we just love faces. We love face-to-face communication. We love seeing people face-to-face. Humanity just likes faces. We're talking about just putting a face on technology so that it's a bit more friendly, a bit more empathetic, a bit more engaging, that has an emotional response, and therefore we find it to be a better, more pleasurable experience.
That's Mike Seymour. He's a researcher and academic at the University of Sydney. You can see his talk at TED.com.